theme for these four sessions is one for which I didn't come prepared, because it hadn't occurred to me that the kind of interest to which these presentations respond would be a priority matter here. That is, explaining another vision of the church than the one which is represented by what in the title we call mainstream understandings. I'll come back in a minute to what mainstream means in this kind of usage. But first, a word of recognition or appreciation for the hospitality of Holden, or at least of Walter Bowman, in thinking that this might be something worth talking about. It is recognizing that there are, in the history of Christianity, divergent visions of what the church ought to be, that Lutheranism, from which the Holden constituency largely comes, is within one of these very firmly, and that there is another, which it's sometimes my business to interpret, which is worth finding out about and conversing with. The particular denominational institutions to which I relate are of the Mennonite denomination, but I'm speaking now not of that denomination alone or mostly, but of a type of understanding of the church which existed before and exists quite apart from that particular denominational form, just as there are many kinds of Lutherans and other kinds of mainstream Christianity. Now, there are limits to the validity of talking in terms of type. That is, saying that there are major models, families of churches, or families of ideas of the church, that can tie us to bygone epochs in which there was a dramatic polarization between one approach and another. It can overlook common experiences since then, things that different types of traditions have learned from one another, or things that they have in common borrowed from somewhere else. For instance, all of our denominations have borrowed from Pietism, from fundamentalism, and thereby are in many ways more alike than the initial differences which led to division or even persecution in the classical period made it seem. So there are some disadvantages and some limits to comparing types of concept of the church. And yet I still think there is some value to it if we do it with the proper modesty about what we can prove. Now, what is meant by the mainstream vision to which I'm to present an alternative? There are two obvious ways to define it, and they coincide, at least the alternative to both is the same. One is in terms of civil power, political establishment. In the Reformation of the 16th century, there were three major Reformation movements which had, each in its own place, the support of the respective civil governments. There was Anglicanism, which we now call Episcopalianism in North America, which had the support of the government of Great Britain. There was Lutheranism, which had the support of the governments of numerous principalities in Central Europe and Scandinavia. And there was the Reformed approach, which had the support of the governments of various Swiss cantons and individual city-states scattered around the Roman Empire, Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. And before long, the nations coming into being of the Netherlands, Hungary, and Scotland, and maybe we could even leap over a century and say New England, which was one of the last of the great Calvinist or Reformed theocracies for a century. So civil establishment is one of the definitions of mainstream religion. And certainly Lutheranism is one of the classic forms. The other measure is numerical. The sociologists speak of the equivalent of establishment when a given body is so numerous that it acts as if it were formally authorized by the government or by the powers that be, even though there doesn't exist anymore in our society the formality of government supporting a church. And some people would say that then, in the culture that arose out of the American frontier, Methodism is quasi-established or quasi-mainstream. Or in the Bible Belt of the South, the Southern Baptists. But whether we go by the criterion of an origin and a theology and a structure which claimed establishment in the strict historic sense, or by some sociological equivalent, in either case, there's something comparable in those traditions with regard to how they'll work at being responsible in society, how they'll work at the meaning of membership, how they'll work at the mission of the church in the world, which for which the slogan mainstream is obviously a very blunt description and very undiscriminating, but still not meaningless. Within this effort to describe an alternative, my assignment for today, or the title for today, is an alternative way of reading the history. Well, what is the mainstream way of reading the history of the church in the world? I don't think I'm unfair to the standard textbooks and popular understandings in playing it back this way. The history of the church has been made of a step, or is to be recounted when we study the history, as a series of steps forward. In the late first century and the second, Christianity moved forward, thank God, out of the narrowness of Judaism into the mainstream culture of the Greco-Roman world, the culture that we call Hellenistic. Christians were for a long time a minority within that culture, but they made their home in it. They used its language, they read its philosophers, they explained themselves to that culture. The main literary figures of the second century are people we call apologetes. That means they made an apology, not in the modern English sense of being ashamed of yourself, but in the classic sense of stating the case for their position in literary Greek, which included sloughing off the Jewish background and, in fact, the developments of the first fringes of Christian anti-Semitism. In the fourth century, there was another major progress. If the first could have been called Hellenization, the second could be called Romanization. Christianity came to be increasingly identified with the power structure of the Roman Empire. The man Constantine is the symbol of that, although he isn't fully responsible for its happening. This included the end of persecution, obviously, but much more than that. It included the beginnings of the favoring of the church by the civil authorities, and even the beginning of the administration of the church by the civil authorities. It was Constantine who convened the Council of Nicaea, which set up the great classic Nicene Creed. It was he, actually, who is reported by the stories to have contributed in a determining way to its exact phrasing at the crucial point. So we now have an identification of church, society, and the empire, which most readers of church history consider to be at least that long progress. And the progress continued, although it became somewhat more ambiguous. That is, it's not all good. But at least one more element was generally thought to be good, and that can be spoken of, depending on which side of the process you look at, as the Christianization of Europe above the Alps, or as the Germanization of Christianity. The story came to be carried now no longer by Romans or Mediterranean people, but by Charlemagne and his successors. And of course, that's the story that leads to us. And even the notion of a Holy Roman Empire in the High Middle Ages was a Germanic notion and no longer a Roman notion. And that meant that Europe is Christendom. The word Christendom in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance period meant Europe, meant the world seen as, at the same time, a geographic and cultural unity under the empire and the pope, and a religious unity in that everybody believes the same thing and the rest of the world doesn't. Now, it comes to be recognized in this mainstream vision of history that things started to go wrong in the midst of these steps forward, that the papacy became too presumptuous, and the Crusades were a little too self-righteous and brutal, and the piety and the theology of the common people got a little shallow. So there was a need for reform, for reformation and change, clarification, purification, but it could be done within the stream of the society itself. That is, the way to have a reformation is that the church itself should reform itself. You get a good pope instead of a bad pope. Or you form a monastic movement which will work as a leaven within the inadequate church to make it more adequate, but you assume that the available structures are to be used so that the church should let herself be reformed by herself. The church is capable of reformation. But then there arises, on the other side, a more radical criticism. It's present before the 16th century Reformation, but it breaks through there in the most clear form. And this has come to be called, in the last generation of historical scholarship, the Radical Reformation. The phrase itself, or its currency, comes from George Hunston Williams, church history professor at Harvard, who wrote an enormous summary of what was known about these movements a generation ago, the Radical Reformation, speaking specifically of the 16th century. It's more radical in form, that is, it condemns more of what has happened since Constantine. In fact, it especially condemns what Constantine stands for. Not the man, that he was a bad guy more than somebody else, now he may have been a very sincere person, but what he had come to represent. And it wasn't these people who had invented the idea that Constantine represented a great turning point in the history of the church. That had already been taught by church historians for 1,000 years. But they taught it as progress, that finally powers of this world are supporting the church rather than fighting the church. But these more radical critics said that that great change in the age of Constantine really meant not that Constantine was vanquished and the empire became a servant, but the church had sold out and had purchased establishment at the cost of faithfulness. Not only were they more radical in their approach to what's wrong, going deeper in their analysis of where it went wrong and why it went wrong, but they were also, that meant, critical of more things with regard to the content of what must be changed. They agreed with the other Protestants that the notion of the Mass as a sacrifice in the ritual sense is not biblical and should be set aside. They agreed with the other Protestants that the notion of justification by faith must be restored, and the notion of earning any kind of righteousness before God through good works must be set aside, if that's what the Catholics really believe. But they also challenged some other things that the mainstream reformers didn't. One of them was the very formal link of the bond between church and state, that the churches of the Protestant Reformation, all three of the mainstream churches, were actually reformed by the state. That meant they were governed by the state, and it took the state to get them out from under the Catholic bishops so that you can have a reformation. These radical reformers, since they believed that what had gone wrong in the first place was largely related to the fact that Constantine had taken the control of the church, couldn't believe that using the state to reform the church would be an adequate way to make a sufficiently profound correction. And therefore they called for non-governmental church structures, the local congregation, the meeting between Christians of various places, which later came to be called the synod, structures that would not be subject to the control of the civil government. That's one of the formal deep debates, what we now call the issue of church and state. And the other was what is symbolized by the issue of baptism, which we'll come to in another session, but not simply the question of who ought to be baptized, but what it does to the church to have everybody be baptized. And their insistence was that Christians should expect to be a voluntary minority in the world rather than having Christianity be the religion of everyone, the compulsory religion of everyone. Because in the 16th century, it was a civil crime not to baptize all the babies.
The slogans which have been used by historians in our time to contrast these two views of Reformation are in the title which was announced. They are only historian slogans. We shouldn't think that they were used by the people in that period. Reformation has come to be thought of by the historians as that kind of change which corrects, clarifies, restores the faithfulness, but seeks to do it and believes it succeeds in doing it with the whole body of the existing church. So Luther took all of his province of Saxony with the guidance of his prince and made it all Lutheran. There weren't any Catholics left. The whole Reformation was done with the existing structures or with changes that enabled you to take all the existing structures except the top. And you take off the bishop and put on the prince as an emergency bishop, and then he goes through and does what can be done with the existing structures. So Reformation is using the existing structures to correct themselves. And the other view is referred to by the slogan coiners of the church history community as restoration or restitution, in which the claim is we can't use the existing structures to correct themselves because they are incorrigible, because they're what's wrong, and therefore we must start over, or God wants to start over. So we start, we let the Bible work again, or we reach back to the Bible or forward to the Bible and start again because the thing went off the track. And you don't try to fix a spoiled story by gradually correcting certain specific things wrong with it. You start over. And that is, you're willing to have a deeper break with the immediate past in order to have a deeper unity with Scripture as the norm for Reformation. Now, that's the slogan way of describing the difference. Now, who are these radicals or restitutionists? I move now from a type description to a little narrative. The first of the groups that fit in this context, although not quite as clearly defined and certainly not as accessible to the historians, are the Waldensian movement of the 12th century, late 12th century, which just celebrated its 8th centennial. There was a wide-reaching fermentation going on in the 11th and 12th centuries in the territory between what is now central France, Lyon, and northern Italy, Lombardy, in which the special focus of complaint was the wealth of the bishops. The way the other structures of society had fallen apart in the Middle Ages, what was left to run the society was really more the ecclesiastical structure than anything else, so bishops became enormously powerful and wealthy and paraded that wealth and thought it had something to do with the glory of God that they went around in gold. This provoked all kinds of criticism, and there were various movements that called themselves Christ's poor through the 11th and 12th centuries. But at the end of the 12th century, especially two movements crystallized out of that broader fermentation and created formal expression. One of them was the Franciscan movement, which got the authorization of the papacy to do its own poor thing and exist as a critique and as a mission within the unity of the Roman Catholic community. But 30 years before, there was another man, Pierre Vaudès, or Peter Waldo, from Lyon, from a wealthy business background, who one day just encountered the figure of Christ in the Gospels, who said, if you want to follow me, you have to leave everything. So he did, and dedicated his capital and his own skills as a leader to preaching that in the language of the people, which was a great breakthrough just about 20 or 30 years before Francis of Assisi started doing the same thing. He thought he had authorization from the Pope too. That is, he didn't set out to be a schismatic. But his local bishop didn't like these people preaching around in his diocese, preaching about poverty and making the gospel come alive in the language of the people, so he forbade it. These people refused to be forbidden, which made them an underground movement. The Waldensian movement exists to this day, and in one sense, it's the oldest Protestant community. In the 16th century, it lined up more or less with the Reformed Reformation. But for three centuries, it lived on its own as the first model of what we call radical reformation. That is, accepting the fact that the existing hierarchical structures of the Roman Catholic community and the existing mass of membership of the Roman Catholic community is not reformable. So if we want to be faithful, we'll just have to start over. And we'll start over by reading about Jesus and preaching about Jesus and living the way he tells us to and seeing what kind of community comes out of that. The second major expression is again the product of a wider fermentation, which we know very little about in our Western European and North American traditions. A massive Reformation movement took place in the 15th century, 100 years before Luther, beginning around the personage of John or Jan Hus or Hus. He was a famous preacher in Prague, the center of the culture which we now call Czech, Bohemia, and Moravia. That was a massive national movement of Reformation in the light of the teachings of the Bible as had been found by these people, mostly in following the initiative of Wycliffe, who was British. But of course they were all reading the same Bible and all writing in Latin, so there was an international culture of people wanting Reformation. The Hussite movement became a national movement, became a political national uprising against the empire. Hus was himself put to death by the Council of Constance. He had been given by the emperor a safe conduct, meaning the promise that he could come to the council and get home again. But the council itself broke that promise and burned him at the stake. This led to a massive national uprising and several years of partly military and partly diplomatic conflict until it was finally settled that the Czechs could have a degree of church autonomy, expressed at that time by the fact that they could celebrate the Eucharist with the cup and not only with the bread being given to the laity that had become the symbol of their criticism of the Roman Catholic tradition, but much of the rest of what they wanted by way of Reformation they finally lost, and the empire politically started roping them back in and breaking the promises of relative autonomy that had been made to the princes of Moravia and Bohemia. As a result of the inadequacy of that national Reformation, there came into being a free church movement, that is, a group of communities that didn't take their orders from the government and formed voluntary gatherings. It began in the 1450s, but finally was organized in 1467, so that's the date that is used, so they've just had their fifth centennial. They were called the Unity of Brethren, or Unitas Fratrum. That movement existed, continued for a century and a half until it was wiped away by the 30 Years' War and the re-Catholicization of the Czech lands. Some of them continued to exist as refugees elsewhere in Europe and had a part to share in the constitution of a new movement in the 18th century called the Moravian Brethren, who weren't in Moravia anymore. But the main specimens of radical Reformation that I need to report on come later, follow up these first foretastes. In the 16th century, we have the movement which is probably most accessible as a theological type because it came into being at the same time that the other Protestant movements came into being, so that we can find these people conversing with Luther or Calvin or with the Catholicism of the time. So that even to this day, we use 16th century types to identify where these people come from and how they differ. It's also a usable model for this type because of the fact that through the arbitrariness and the chanciness of migration and the selective persecution, the descendants of these people have survived and come to North America in much greater numbers than the Waldenses are the Moravians. The Mennonite and the Hutterian brethren are the living descendants of communities going back to the 16th century radical Reformation origins. They didn't have any central organization. That was partly because they thought that central organization was part of the problem, and partly because the persecution of the time, which left them no liberty at all, wouldn't have permitted the structuring of a central organization if they had wanted one. And that meant they were very varied. So under the heading Anabaptist, which was the term used for them in the 16th century, various kinds of things came into being, not all of which fit together. That is, some of them, they were called Anabaptists because they did baptize adults on confession of faith, but they also believed, just as everybody else did, in righteous violence, where most of the Anabaptists and the ones that survived were nonviolent. Some of them were highly visionary and thought the end of the world was coming in a few years, as also did numerous people in the mainstream, including Martin Luther for a couple of weeks at least once.
So there
was a great variety in these movements, but what settled out of them was a model of the free church, that is, of a way of being Christian community without needing the government, in fact being able to do it against the prohibition of government, and without the link with the state that was traditionally necessary since Constantine. I speak of the Anabaptist model then. The word Anabaptist itself was thrown at them by outsiders. It means rebaptizers, because they baptized their members as adults on confession of faith. And of course, in the first generation, everyone they baptized as an adult on confession of faith had been baptized once before automatically as a suckling by a Catholic priest. So the reproach of rebaptism is what gave them their name. For them, that wasn't the biggest question. And of course, they didn't think they were rebaptizing because they didn't believe that that Catholic ritual classified as baptism biblically. More accessible than the 16th century as a cultural model would be the radical Reformation of the 17th century British Reformation. This doesn't fit the origins of the Reformed or the Lutheran traditions, or even the Anglican tradition, but it does fit the origins of our Anglo-Saxon culture. It was in the 17th century that the continuing tension between Catholic theology, Calvinist theology, and the established Anglican Church produced the increasing radicalization of what we call the Puritan movement, which began first simply as a critical movement within the Church of England. And then they began to say that they should reject establishment itself, and some of them got kicked out because they said that in the late 16th century. And then some of them said, not all of them, we should reject infant baptism. Those who didn't continued to practice infant baptism are today called Congregationalists. But they continued to get critical of more and more things. And finally, it wound up in a political revolution led by the general Oliver Cromwell, who, as you know, took over England for 20 years, interrupted the succession of kings and queens, and then finally was put down by the restoration of royalty. Out of that radicalization of Puritanism came not only Cromwell, a theocratic vision which worked for a while and then failed, but the Baptists, which became numerically the largest of the movements from this radical Reformation rootage in over the centuries through the effectiveness of their missionary undertakings. And out of the same radical Puritanism came George Fox and the Friends, the Quakers, who had a major part in what went on in England from then on and in colonial America, and are more accessible than the 16th century Anabaptists if we want to read the history, the story of the history of what dissenters and minorities can do in a culture that tolerates them. Since then, there have been more groups like this scattered through the later centuries, but as they come to be more and as our society gets more decentralized and more pluralistic, they're also less dramatic and need to be less original. In the 18th century, out of the Pietist movement in Germany, there came a group which is today called in North America Church of the Brethren, which, like the Mennonites and the Quakers, rejects war and is of analogous size in North America today. Doesn't exist elsewhere around the world. In the 19th century, in pioneer America, there came into being the movements now called disciples, or Christians, or Campbellites, an ecumenical movement in that they wanted to overcome the splintering of Christianity by having only the Bible be a norm. In the 19th century, in pioneer America, there came into being the movements now called disciples, or Christians, or Campbellites, an ecumenical movement in that they wanted to overcome the splintering of Christianity by having only the Bible be a norm. There was a similar new beginning in Britain at that time, called Brethren, not related to the other Brethren group of which I spoke, sometimes called Plymouth Brethren, to identify them in some parts of the world. And it keeps on in our time. Something of Pentecostalism is a little like this. There are ricochet forms in the third world, the non-West, in the early period after the Second World War in Japan. A group calling itself the No Church Movement was, for all practical purposes, a part of this radical Reformation model. Today in Zaire, a group called the Church of God on Earth by the Prophet Simon Kibangu, the Church of Jesus Christ on Earth by the Prophet Simon Kibangu, which is a member church of the World Council of Churches, is also, at least in its origins, a peace church. So these models keep arising, but as time goes on, it's less and less clear that this is a pure type, of course, because it takes place within the American mix, so often, where there are so many different models of how to be Christian, none of them really persecuted, except the Jehovah's Witnesses, that we don't get a clear polarization of this view versus that view anymore. And we get, in fact, the strange paradox that a group that is formally committed to this view of the church as a minority, if it is successful in winning people, may cease to be a minority and may become a kind of informal establishment, like the Southern Baptists in Georgia, or maybe pretty soon the Pentecostals in Southern California. That's another theme and a contemporary concern. But now, what are the marks that characterize this whole stream of an alternative vision of reform or restitution? Certainly, the superficial one that matters the most, that is, that's most evident on the surface, but profound, not only on the surface, is the problem of church-state relations. As long as it is the case that there are governments administering churches, which is one of the assumptions of all the mainstream movements when they began in the 16th century, and which control they renounced only reluctantly with the passage of time, then this is a major subject for dissidents. And even if there is separation between church and state, a special vigilance at the point of what the state wants to do with us, its desire to make us its soldiers, to make us patriotic in such a sense that we don't recognize the dignity of other nations and peoples and cultures. The phrase free church focuses not only on voluntary membership, freedom in that sense, the freedom of the individual to join it, but on not being governed by the powers of the state. In that sense, of course, even people who believed, according to their creeds, in established churches when they came to North America had to accept the free church status because the Constitution already provided that. But it usually means something even beyond the critique of the church-state link, or of informal establishments, or of infant baptism. It means an awareness that there are in this world powers that oppress people, that don't leave us free, that don't leave the gospel free, and that place before us the challenge of saying, hey, wait, rather than being things that we should baptize and integrate in a vision of Christendom. Voluntary church membership, separation of church and state, rejection of war, which is characteristic of most of these traditions, although not of the Baptists. A focus on the need for the organization of Christians in Christian community to be more binding than simply all belonging to something, which has taken us over officially and automatically, whether through infant baptism or through some other way of being established. But whether I am a member of the Christian community is something I have to commit myself to, something I have to decide. I may decide that I accept it as a gift, but even that decision must be my decision, otherwise it isn't valid. And this communal commitment to the church as a body being more than simply a point where we hear preaching has its major focus, speaking in historical generalization, at two points. One is how I make my decisions. Do I make all my own decisions after I've heard the sermon and after I've been told the truth? Then I am free to be an individualist. Or do my brothers and sisters have something to say about my decisions as a Christian? We'll talk about that especially on Friday. And secondly, an economic dimension to sharing. The material gifts with which we live are not for me alone to decide how to use, but are the agenda for brotherhood process. Sometimes the Hutterian brethren are the monument of the possibility that these movements sometimes move into actual community of goods and common purse and constituting communities in that sense. Usually they don't, but they do all have, Quakers and the Mennonites and the Brethren, etc., extensive structures for sharing at points of need, disaster, widowhood, travel needs, refugees. There's a long history of mutual economic responsibility among the people that have made the commitment to be in the body of Christ together. In 1547, I think it was, or 57, there was a group of Anabaptists from Strasbourg meeting, and they didn't have the right to exist, so they met in the woods about 5 miles out of town, and a few young men, or boys, seeing them leaving town to go to this meeting, which was a very rare thing because it took a lot of planning to have a clandestine meeting in the woods, people coming from considerable distances, and therefore it went all night. Two of these young men came back and reported to the Strasbourg City Police the next morning, which was a Lutheran organization, what had gone on in this worship service in the woods. And one of the things that they reported was how the baptism of some new members had taken place, and one of the three things that were involved in this baptism was the pledge, if it's ever needed, all my possessions are at the disposal of the brothers and sisters. That wasn't community of goods, but it was a radical economic commitment in the church as community. There would be more elements, but I think these are the main ones to get started. Perhaps another, but to state it is perhaps already open to debate about whether it should mean that, an ethic of discipleship. Now, what does that mean? It means so many different things. That's why I'm not sure it's a good term to use, but for them it meant that Jesus is not only the Lord, but also the model. He doesn't simply tell us what to do, he did it first. So his response to the enemy, his response to the temptations of power, his response to the call of settling into comfort in the Christian life have to be ours as well, so that we don't deal with him only as a savior and get our moral guidance somewhere else, from common sense or from the orders of creation, but we get our moral guidance from the kind of life he lived, including the risk of the kind of death he died. And that gives to Jesus a place as a model of the Christian lifestyle, which the mainstream Catholic and Protestant bodies consciously said he shouldn't have, because that jeopardizes his uniqueness, or it risks self-righteousness, or it jeopardizes society, or it confuses salvation and sanctification. Now, so much for introduction. There, I found as I was going along that I had shuffled my papers in such a way that I missed one sheet, but I think it all filled it in somewhere else. So let's go on from here by the kinds of clarification that I can contribute in response to your questions, whether they be on the type itself as an ideal type or on the actual experience of these various underground communities. Yeah.
You mentioned that they knew Jesus as their
model. How do they follow Jesus in rendering Caesar the things which are Caesar? I suspect that for the value of the total exchange, we shouldn't focus only on the pacifism issue, which we've spent some other time on, and that's an edge of it. Well, how did Jesus let Caesar do what he did? He let Caesar crucify him. And he let Caesar collect taxes coercively, but he didn't help Caesar with Caesar's wars.
You realize you're talking to a passing show.
Yeah, that's clearly
recover things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if you keep on living as Jesus didn't, you'll have more questions in relating to the civil society. But one way of saying it would be that they were the people who insist that you have to keep asking Jesus questions, so that you have to ask, even after Constantine, is it really Caesar's business to run the church? And their answer was no. All the other Christians said yes. Thank God we have a Christian Caesar. Now we'll let him run the church. He convenes a Nicene council. We'll praise God for the peace that permits that, and use him to get rid of our heretics, and then he'll use us to hold the empire together. That's a beautiful cooperation. Where these radicals would say, no, we still have to ask Jesus' question, and that isn't really Caesar's business.
Well, it's a matter of constant decision that among the brethren.
I think I use the phrase vigilance, or even suspicion. You don't expect a world in which there'll be no Caesar, but you generally don't expect him to be saving the church.
So it's a matter of a constant vigilance to decide to what degree you can cooperate with the state and follow the requirements of the state.
Yes, it would be
taxes.
Case related, what is Caesar asking for? If he wants me to drive on the right side of the road, that's probably a reasonable request. Even if he wants me to stay under 55, that's maybe partly a reasonable request. If he wants me to go off and kill people, that's none of his business. And which things he asks will depend enormously, of course, on the varieties of culture. Well, it depends on what he wants to do with the taxes. And some of these radical bodies,
usually he is going to use a small amount of the tax money correctly and a large amount of the tax money. In a case like that,
there are divisions within this tradition on how much that's our business. Some would simply say, Caesar is coercive, he comes and gets it, that discharges me for responsibility for what he does with it. And I guess that would really be the majority who would say that. I don't approve of what he does, but it's his now. He took it, he had his name on it, and he came and got it. He didn't give me any choice about whether to turn it over to him. One of the streams of the 16th century, and several of the Quakers in the 17th, and in colonial America, and today, say, no, I continue to be responsible for keeping Caesar from doing that with tax money. So there is a tax objection movement, which has always been there a little. It was the most radical, really, in the 16th and 17th century, because then the governments were a little more honest. They had regular taxes for some purposes, and if they had a war, they had to have a special war tax. So you really know these two guilders now are for war. And then the Anabaptists generally said, we can't pay it. Please either let us pay to some other fund the same amount, road building or post office or museums or something, or you'll have to come and get it. Now it happened that the Hutterite brethren in Moravia, with their communities of 200 members and farms of 1,000 acres, they had great big granaries, and so it was very easy to come and get it. In fact, they actually went underground for a while and stopped having common property so that they couldn't be expropriated so easily. So there was both. There was a refusal to pay on the grounds that it is our business, and then there was willingness to let it be taken on the grounds that once Caesar has taken it, our responsibility to dissent has been discharged. Those are the two lines, and they still both exist.
Public education.
Public education, there's also been both lines. There are some places where these communities, well, let me start back over. In the 16th century, they invented public education. They had schools for everybody in the whole Christian family, including even the girls, when nobody else believed in that. But then with the colonial experience, they very often had schools just for themselves. The first publication in North America in the field of education was written by an immigrant named Doc in eastern Pennsylvania, who was serving a Mennonite school. So they had a vision for basic education. When the government started running the schools, it was just a local matter of whether they were of decent quality and whether they were teaching morality and whether we could trust our children to them. The radical left or right, depending on how you run your spectrum, today, the Old Order Amish in North America, still believe that they can tolerate public schools only if they're close to home. If the government says we must take your children to the city to run them to school, they are then teaching a lifestyle which is counter to the conviction of their parents, and the government shouldn't have the right to do that. So the Amish run their own schools and have even had some surprising victories up to the Supreme Court to have the right to do it. And that's not on the grounds of church versus state, but it's on the grounds of whether anybody has the right to take children away from their parents and teach them a lifestyle that the parents disapprove of. But most Mennonites and most Friends haven't stayed out of the public schools for that purpose. The Friends have a great tradition, especially in Britain, but also in the east of the States, of elite private education. That is, that's better in quality than the public schools, and which is has very often been of such high quality that non-Quakers send their children there to get a rounder liberal arts education. They were non-coercive long before Montessori, and quite a number of innovations in educational techniques have come from these Quaker schools. So it's been a, almost as on the tax question, it's been a mix of yes but and no but, never completely chopping off and never completely satisfied with the mainstream.
I have a question. Are the Quakers included in that group of churches that use Jesus as an example?
The original Quakers clearly were right within what I'm talking about. Quakerism has evolved in a different way than the other groups because of the relatively greater freedom which was found in the Anglo-Saxon world as over against continental Europe for the first centuries, and the resulting economic prosperity and cultural development, urbanization. So that today, there are many Quakers whose understanding of what it means to worship God in the Spirit wouldn't be very closely linked with Jesus anymore. But historically, they were very much in the same vein I've been talking about, and there are still many like that. There are still many Quakers who are very Christ-centered. But you get an image of Quakerism from Philadelphia and the American Friends Service Committee and Richard Nixon that goes off in other directions. Some of it is gone American and fundamentalist, just like the rest of us, and some of it has gone in the direction of great respect for other religions, and disrespect for outward forms, as a result of which the theological ideas can be very vague and varied.
How many major themes did you, you had church and state, commitment to community, and ethics of discipleship with...
Well, it's hard to itemize cleanly because they overlap. That is, church and state is an issue of church structure, it's also an issue of ethics regarding the war, so is that one or two? And likewise, voluntary membership, that relates to church and state, but it's an issue in its own right, as it will show up in baptism tomorrow. So whether it's three or five, or even more, will just depend on what we consider to be a clean analysis. I would say this the commitment to community had two branches, one economic and one decision making.
Yeah.
So it keeps ramifying the closer we look at it.
I think you mentioned pietism earlier. Is that still, I still know enough in
this? Does everybody know what pietism is? The historians use the term a different way from contemporary polemics. Sometimes today it's just used as a smear word for people who don't like other people who like to pray too much or believe miracles or something else silly. Historically it was a movement within continental Protestantism, which means mostly within Lutheranism, although it also had its Reformed parallels, which sought to revitalize the mass church, which by then, middle of the 18th century, was 200 years old, a state church with its ponderous structures and its self-confidence and its orthodoxy, tried to revitalize that without changing it at the top or on the outside, which meant you keep the parish structure and you keep ordination and you keep theology, but down underneath then you have real Christian fellowship in other groups. You have Bible study groups and prayer groups and voluntary organizations to send Bibles to the heathen, and the beginnings of the missionary movement were there. So pietism was a voluntary movement within the mainstream churches, which hoped to revitalize them without division and without falling into heresy at any point where orthodoxy had been established. In that sense, the pietists came closer to the free church people of their time. As I said, the Brethren movement came out of part of this pietist movement. And there were actual conversations recorded between the pietists within the mainstream churches and the free church people, saying, you could come back in if you'd have meetings like ours and just accept the umbrella over us, which doesn't really matter too much anymore. We can still have our free fellowship and our discipleship and our free sharing and our deep piety without needing to fight the establishment. And there were some places in which actually free church people came back into the state churches as pietists, because then you'd have less trouble with the authorities. But I think what is meant, what I meant when I referred to the impact of pietism on all of us, is that both people from the mainstream churches and people from the free churches have, in the centuries since then, picked up many strands of how we understand our Christian life to work that have come from those people. That is, a warmer, freer, more spontaneous kind of prayer. The hymnology of the Wesleys. You have a lot of Wesley in your service book. Well, that's pietism. It's a more subjective, more introspective, more individual understanding of how you go about believing. The foreign missionary movement, that is, that you set up separate organizations to send missionaries overseas, that was an invention of the pietists. There's many things that both people in the mainstream and people from the free churches have adopted together. And in that sense, it's still with us, certainly. There would be an enormous overlap between a Church of the Brethren hymn book and a Lutheran hymn book in things that don't come either from Luther or from the Radical Fathers, but from these later movements of renewal. Or the popularity, the accessibility of Billy Graham. People from all our churches would listen to Billy Graham because his message is not specific to either one of these polar positions.
Is Billy Graham a Baptist or whatever
yeah.
church?
Billy Graham is technically a Baptist, but as I said near the end of my history, the history gets messed up to the end, because groups that have the form of a free church, like Baptists, with the local congregational autonomy and adult baptism, come to be a kind of establishment in places like Georgia and North Carolina, because they dominate the place numerically. And that's what Billy Graham comes from. He comes from established Baptist America. He wouldn't be radical in any sense, either social ethics or economics. But he is formally a member of the Baptist communities.
I was wondering how come it draws so many people to these rallies. Is it because of his teaching? I mean, did a lot of searching for...
You should have been here last week. We had a group reading a book on why conservative churches grow, which I think is parallel to why Billy Graham has an audience. And I shouldn't try to capsule that answer, but it was, I think it relates to this issue of establishment with which we kind of wound up, that it is possible for a religion, regardless of whether you have popes, and regardless of whether the prince runs the church, it is possible to think of Christianity as being part of keeping things as they are, being safe, trusting that God is on our side, trusting that things will go our way. And that official confidence, that's the mood of establishment, regardless of at what age you baptize people. And in that sense, Billy Graham and his audience are mainstream America. And there are just a lot of people in the mainstream. That's what mainstream means. It's where there are the most people. And he speaks to that desire of people to be assured that basically God is an American and happy with us at our best, and we can go on in confidence. The next three sessions will deal with specific aspects of this alternative understanding of the church, which I've just located historically this time.